Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. It's been almost two weeks since the deadly mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. And now that we know more information, we want to revisit what could have led to these tragedies and consider how we might prevent these attacks in the future. Joan Donovan is the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy's Shorenstein Center. When we spoke earlier today, I began by asking if shooters display online warning signs that law enforcement and family should be more aware of.
So one of the things that we often see online is a proliferation of these manifesto-style threats. And so one of the problems with constantly reacting to warnings or constantly reacting to anything anybody posts online is you really tilt the power in favor of people who are potentially not going to be carrying out mass violence, but are interested in causing a lot of chaos and disruption. And they're from working with these platform companies as well, there really doesn't seem to be any particular pattern on large-scale social media platforms that would be indicative of saying, oh, when someone does this, then they are more likely to commit violence. However, if you look at other signs, including, you know, are they, dressing up in fatigues and patrolling their neighborhood, as was happening in Nevada recently? Are they amassing large amounts of weapons? Then those are signs that someone might be teetering on the brink of committing some kind of violent act.
So then what's the role of websites like Facebook or YouTube or maybe less mainstream sites like 8chan, where the El Paso shooter had left this racist screed in sort of controlling or trying to control the spread of this hate online? I'm thinking of, the Christchurch shooting and how Facebook spent 24 hours removing 1.5 million posts of that video. How do they control this?
That's a really important point, and that's something that we need to devote a lot more attention to. When we talk about controlling the spread, I think what we're really talking about is to what degree are we going to moderate for this online? It would behoove platform companies to think more about, well, when we see that this account or influencer is using racist language, to what degree do they limit the amplification of that content? Do they restrict it to people who are already subscribed? Do they put it on a do not recommend list? For instance, Spotify doesn't recommend hate rock bands. And so even though there might be hate rock bands on their platform, they don't put them into their recommendation systems. And so there's ways in which platform companies can intervene, both from completely banning or deplatforming or taking down content, all the way towards using the algorithmic systems and recommendation systems that they've built to either throttle the spread of this content or to remove it from reaching new audiences that weren't even looking for it in the first place.
But at the same time, it does seem like there's a bit of a whack-a-mole going on the internet, and that there's this tension between free speech online and accountability and countering extremism. I've been thinking a bit about the Tsarnaev brothers and their radicalization online before the marathon bombing. But there's other kinds of organizing that can also happen online that might not, you know, be radicalization in a sense, the Hong Kong protests or the Arab Spring. So how do you balance the good with the bad and deal with this whack-a-mole problem?
Yeah, I think it's really important that we not conflate the content, right? So when we see something where people are using online technologies to coordinate for increased rights to coordinate for, in the case of Hong Kong, really important civil rights, that we don't conflate the content and the use of the technologies as either all uses are bad or all uses are good. Of course, we've had mass shootings. We've had all of these problems, misogyny, racism prior to the internet. The issue is, to what degree does this technology amplify or exaggerate or magnify these problems and increase the capacity for people who would be considered fringe or ideas that would be considered fringe to reach into the mainstream and to really shape the way in which the public discusses their crimes.
But who should be making these decisions about what's okay and what's not online?
Well, that's a really good question. We don't have any regulation that's going to, in any in the U.S. context anyway, set those standards. And so we're in a situation in the U.S. that is different from the situation in Germany, where there are standards set by the government that require websites not to share and sell Nazi paraphernalia and propaganda, for instance. And so there are ways of doing internet content moderation in other countries that we can look to as models. In the U.S., there's issues around what we call free speech and what it is really meant to be. So the free speech has a lot to do with what you can say to and about the government. However, if you own a business and someone comes in and is screaming about, you know, any kind of racist language, you can't just walk into a business and do that. You can't just walk into a hotel lobby and say, you know, I want all of the immigrants to leave. You can't do that. People are going to kick you out. But online, we don't have the same methods or ways of moving people around. And so we do rely heavily on these companies, perhaps too much, to set those standards, and those standards become very uneven. This perpetuates the problem of whack-a-mole, because we see people who want to traffic in hate speech or want to share these manifestos and these ideas will move around between platforms if they do find themselves getting resistance from one.
And in your research, you often make the point that the media, in some ways, unwittingly helps spread white supremacists and other extremist ideologies following attacks or mass shootings. And so looking back on the last couple of weeks, did the coverage of the El Paso shooter's racist screed disturb you?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a lot different than what we were dealing with 2 years ago. So while we still have ways to go, the media is now attuned to that they shouldn't be promoting these people's names, that they shouldn't reprint the manifesto in total without giving any kind of warning or context to their audiences. They also know now not to link back to anonymous message boards or white supremacist message boards, where their readers can then go and potentially fall down the rabbit hole. So I think media has changed. But I'll tell you, the one thing that I'm especially proud of the media for doing is I didn't see any evidence of the media going to white supremacists in particular and giving white supremacists a new platform to explain these ideas. Now, a few years ago, when we saw these kinds of things happening, different events, oftentimes what journalists would go right to white supremacists to try to validate these ideas. And I was a big proponent of what we call strategic silence, which is to say journalists should provide the context. They should explain the violence. They should explain what happens. But under no circumstances should they go to a white supremacist to validate these ideas and to give that person notoriety.
So I hear you on that. And part of what we try to do on this show anyway is offer that context and understanding of the facts, and motives is something that does come up, you know, as we struggle to understand the why in a seemingly nonsensical, terrible tragedy like El Paso or Dayton. So how should we better cover mass shootings where there are these breadcrumbs, these memes, these online trails that get left behind?
I think that there's a few different stories that we can always tell about what we might want to start describing as domestic terrorism events, which is to say that readers and audiences should understand that the reason for the violence isn't random. It's to ensure that whatever breadcrumbs that are left online are read and reread and amplified through the media ecosystem. And so journalists have to understand that there are different ways they can tell those stories. And part of those stories that journalists should be telling isn't just about the politicians' reactions or, you know, going to the manifesto and reading key passages, but that journalists should think about, well, what are the impacts on the community here? How are people going to go on with their days? How are they going to live through this? As well as how are the targeted communities, in this case in El Paso, he was targeting what he believed to be immigrants. But of course, we know that there are plenty of U.S. citizens that live and that live in the community of El Paso. But, you know, we need to.
And do you mean just the community of El Paso, or, you know, there was racist language in his screeds against the mm-hmm. Latinx community? So do you mean also the Latinx community?
Both. I would say that we also need to turn our attention to, well, what are the civil society organizations like the National Hispanic Media Coalition that are assembling these impact stories and are dealing with the trauma that's been inflicted upon this community, and how do they want media to change, right? We have to look at and listen to, well, how do these victims of these crimes, but then this community, what responses are they asking for, and what ways in which do they want to interact with the media? And we also need to understand that throughout this, that there are many stories of resilience and of people coming together through this. And that also, one thing that strikes me that we're not covering in the media is interracial solidarity, which is to say that what happens in moments like these isn't that communities go and lock their doors and don't come together, but that they come together and there are vigils and meetings and ways in which the community does come together in resolve and resilience in reaction to events like this. And so the more the media can cover those stories, the better we're going to be when we confront the next wave of violence. Because unfortunately, when we turn our attention to these waves of violence and we don't show that they're not effective, then the next person is inspired to do more violence because they believe they're winning.
Joan Donovan is the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy's Shorenstein Center. Joan, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Let's turn now to Franklin Peralta. He's a Dominican U.S. citizen, a Jamaica Plain resident, father of two daughters, and a campaign organizer with English for New Bostonians. Franklin, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you just heard Joan Donovan there, and of course, I'm not asking you to speak for an entire community, but what responses are you looking for personally?
I would say, adding to what she was saying, is the same thing. It's like focusing on the lost, on the life that were lost, and all what they are contributing to our communities. These are hardworking people that are really contributing to the economy, contributing to the society where they live. That should be the focus, what we have lost here.
What was the focus in your family?
It was a tough situation because we were scheduled to go out to a protest on Sunday. The association of people that have to do with mass incarceration and jails were having their convention here, and everything is connected, and we were going to protest them because we should stop putting people in jail as a business, making profit out of that. So when the shooting happened, I was scared, man. I was thinking that maybe I should stay home, maybe I shouldn't take my daughters to a public demonstration where these people may have guns. We know that these events inspire the next one, and I was trying to think how to deal with the situation. I told my wife, "Well, maybe I or you can stay home with the kids, and one of us goes out." And that's where it hit me that that's exactly what white supremacists are looking for. They want this is a case of not just domestic terrorism, but like terrorism. Period. They wanna put fear on our hearts. They want us to stay home and not come out and protest this. So with a big empty hole in my stomach, I took my two daughters and we went out and we said we need to stop this.
There were reports today that the Rhode Island Attorney General is investigating claims that someone drove a truck into a group of protesters at a detention facility in that state. So, right. So you did decide to take your daughters to that protest. But how do you talk to them about what happened in El Paso?
We will have to talk to them because, as I was saying, there is going to be a point. Like, we are big listeners of WVUR. We have the radio all the time. And they are going to start asking questions. Why are these people dying? Why is somebody trying to kill us? They are biracial and bicultural. And they say, I'm a Dominican American. They were born here of a Dominican father. They carry their Latino heritage with pride, and when they overhear that was exactly what was targeted, that these white supremacists came out to kill Latinos, to kill Mexicans, they are going to ask why. And I don't have an answer for that. I mean, I could say explain the whole thing with the identity crisis that many white people are going through and how they need a scapegoat. But come on, there are 60 million Latinos in this country. We are abiding by the law. We are doing what we are asked to do in terms of contributing to the economy, trying to create and revitalize communities. So it's really tough when at the same time you feel like you have to go home and hide behind your bed.
And, you know, we talked a bit with Joan Donovan from Harvard's Shorenstein Center a little earlier about the media coverage of the hate-filled screed from the El Paso shooter, and which the FBI says he posted online before the attack. And I'm just wondering, for you, when hearing reports of what was written of this sort of Hispanic invasion of Texas or this idea of a great replacement that is propagated by white supremacists, that white people are being replaced by people of color, how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel horrible because words matter, and you have this has been incentivized from the White House. Like, this, putting a whole community of millions of people in one basket and saying bad things and talking about invasions and talking about murderers and rapists. I mean, it was just a matter of time, right? That these words materialize in this horrible crime that we just saw, and it will continue. I have to say, though, that a lot of people think that, oh, we just have to get rid of the current president and everything is going to be normal. No. I see him as a symptom of a big problem that we have in this society, where the balance of power and the balances of identities are being questioned. You know, they say that this is the first generation that cannot expect that their kids are going to be a better future. Well, if you come from a poor country like myself, that doesn't apply, right? I am expecting my kids to have a better future than what I had. But there are many families here that's a reality. There are many families here that for generations, they had, like, the father had one job and they were able to sustain their family with a job. Maybe that the mother stay home and take care of the kids. All that is coming down. And you have a person in the White House that is promising to bring all that back to this family just because he's singling out one group and say they are the one that we have to blame. How are we immigrants to be blamed for the reality that many people are living where their world is being shaken, and they cannot expect that their kids are going to do better than themselves.
So what do you say to the folks then who feel like their world is being shaken, as you just described?
Yeah, I think we have to come together. When we talk about inclusion, we are not talking about, oh, you have to leave the place so I can come in. Inclusion means another thing. Inclusion means working together. Inclusion means let's find out who's manipulating, who's getting richer and richer in this economy, and who's getting the best part, and who's beneficiating from putting us to fight each other. That's what we should be focusing, trying to come together. And we see many, many examples through history of people coming together and really trying to remove the mask from the people that are behind, beneficiating from putting us to fight.
So over the weekend, NPR Weekend Edition host Lulu Garcia Navarro wrote a piece for The Atlantic that said the media erased Latinos from the story, meaning the story of the El Paso shooting. You read the news, you follow the news. Do you think there's been enough conversation about the actual specific targeting of Latinos in El Paso?
Absolutely not. I don't think so. I can tell you, I've been in this country for 12 years. Many of my family and friends are in the Dominican Republic. They cannot even start to understand why this violence is taking place, why all this mass shooting, why targeting specific groups. I can tell you, if this were happening in the Dominican Republic or in Colombia or in Venezuela, that dozens and dozens of people are being gunned down because who they are, the conversation will be very different. Right now, we will be talking about, you know, the Association of American States, the United Nations, they will be talking about economic sanctions against that country. They may be talking about military intervention to stop the killings. And here, it's just like it stays in the news for 2 days and then we move on. You know, why is that? We need to stop this. I have two daughters and I want them to be safe when they go to a park, to their schools, to their church. And everything is connected. Like, why is this happening here and it's not happening in other countries? We need to keep asking that question.
So, I guess in thinking about your daughters, what are the conversations that they're having with their friends?
You know, we try to protect them the most that we can, but they know that the only way that we can have a healthy society is by really coming together. And they see that in their schools. There are kids with some more privilege than others. There are kids of different colors, of different races and class and social class. But they see that as a place where they come together and they can be kids. Where are we losing that when our kids are growing? There is a moment there where this is lost and we start seeing the other as the enemy. You know what I mean? Like, it's so easy to say, oh, the problem is the White House, the problem is the media. We have many, for example, undocumented Latinos here in Massachusetts. We've been trying to pass laws to protect them, to allow them to be trained and to drive on the street safe. And we cannot pass those laws. We want them to go to the community colleges and have in-state tuition. And again, more than a decade trying to get in-state tuition that other places around here and other even states like Utah already many years ago passed. So, you know, we can talk a lot about the problem is the media, the problem is the White House. And at the same time, we are not doing what we can do to protect Latinos and Latinas here in Massachusetts.
I guess, though, at the same time, and I know sometimes after tragedies, the conversation can get muddled between a real discussion about a real issue and maybe a shooter's motivation. So I don't want to do that. But I do want to acknowledge that there is a legitimate conversation to be had in this country about immigration, about
Absolutely.
Legal and illegal immigration, about what to do about asylum seekers and detention centers. And how do we have that conversation apart from the El Paso shooting in a way that's constructive and actually moves the conversation forward?
I think
– because there are legitimate concerns there from some folks who that there are folks who broke the law who came here, or there's, you know, limited resources to support asylum seekers here in the country. So what is your
– Yeah. Yeah. Let's take, for example, what happened in Mississippi, where they have those raids and almost 700 people were arrested. They were processing chicken. They were processing chicken. How is that?
Because of the ICE raids. And
yes, money. The ICE raids. How is taking these people from their families? How is that making this this place more safe? How is making this this country having more jobs available? You see what I mean? Like, what we are trying to do here is to bring our hardworking ethics and our desire to contribute to a society. And we are being met by all these lies about, oh, they are taking jobs. Oh, they just want, they are freeloaders. How can you be a freeloader and also take the jobs? You know what I mean? Yeah. Let's have the conversation.
So finally, I want to ask you, after El Paso, how are you moving forward personally?
It's tough because I know it's going to happen again, man. It's going to happen again because nothing has changed. You know, I really, it hits me hard every time I hear the police and the media repeating, the shooter acted alone. No, he didn't. Somebody built that gun. Somebody sold that gun. Somebody is paying Congress to not do anything about taking these weapons of war from the hands of civilians. So I go out every day and I look around and like, it's going to happen here? Where is the next town to have this massacre and these strategies happening? So I feel bad because I know it's going to happen again.
That's Franklin Peralta. He's a Dominican U.S. citizen, a Jamaica Plain resident, and a campaign organizer with English for New Bostonians. Franklin, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Jamie Bologna. Stick with us after a short break. This is WBUR's Radio Boston.